Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by Boston University School of Law. Our speaker is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Justice Breyer will discuss his new book, Making Democracy Work, A Judge's View. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, School of Law Dean Maureen O'Rourke.
We're honored that Justice Breyer, a great lawyer and a great man in his own right, has joined us today to talk about his most recent book, Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. Justice Breyer began his legal career as a clerk for Supreme Court Associate Justice Arthur Goldberg. From 1965 to 1967, he served as a special assistant to the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust. He then joined the faculty of Harvard Law School, where he became known as an outstanding scholar. At Harvard, Justice Breyer became known as a leading expert on administrative law and antitrust law, and was the author of two influential books on regulation and a leading casebook on administrative law. Because I am an occasional teacher of intellectual property law, I think first not of these works, but of an article on the uneasy case for copyright and his dissent in Eldred v. Ashcroft when I think of Justice Breyer. Both of those are required reading for anyone interested in copyright law and policy. Justice Breyer returned to Washington as an assistant special prosecutor on the Watergate Special Prosecution Force in 1973, then served as special counsel to the U.S. Senate Committee on the Judiciary from 1974 to 75, and as chief counsel of that committee from 1979 to 80. President Jimmy Carter nominated him to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, where he later served as chief judge. President Bill Clinton appointed him to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1994. Since he has been on the court, Justice Breyer has written two thoughtful and influential books defending a pragmatic approach to constitutional interpretation and judicial review, Active Liberty and Making Our Democracy Work, which he'll talk about today. In characterizing his view, I can't do any better than to quote the description on the dust jacket of that book. Justice Breyer argues for interpreting the Constitution in a way that works in practice. He forcefully rejects competing approaches that look exclusively to the Constitution's text or to the 18th century views of the framers. Instead, he advocates a pragmatic approach that applies unchanging constitutional values to ever-changing circumstances, an approach that will best demonstrate to the public that the Constitution continues to serve us well. The court, he believes, must also respect the roles that other actors, such as the President, Congress, administrative agencies, and the states, play in our democracy, and he emphasizes the court's obligation to build cooperative relationships with them. Today, we're delighted and honored to welcome Justice Stephen Breyer as our inaugural Esdale Lecturer at Boston University School of Law. Justice Breyer.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. It's very nice to be here, even if it's a little cold, but I mean, it's okay. And thank you, Dean, for the nice introduction. And I'm so glad that you're here, Marianne, and your two children, Jamie and Richard, and your son, daughter-in-law. And I just heard from Mike Mohn, and I'd read what he said before about your husband, father-in-law, father, and... Yes, great lawyers in this state. And it's something being a trial lawyer, a great lawyer in Massachusetts. My brother's a trial lawyer. He was, you know, and he makes me clear to me where the cream of the bar is. It's not the judges. I say, you know, hey, we're lawyers too. He says, there's no evidence. He said, but it's true. Great trial lawyers and. At firm Esdale, and Barrett, Jacobs, Mohn, and great friends of this university, great friends of this school. So it's very, very nice for me to be here. And listen to Mohn, he makes sense. He's very truthful. He knows what I always remember. He wrote a letter or something. Somebody had written a letter to say there were something like 40,000, it was one of these legal journals, there were 40,000 odd members of the Massachusetts Bar Association. He wrote in a letter and he said, no, that's wrong. He said, there are only 20,000 odd members. The rest are perfectly normal, he said. That's true. So he's accurate. That was being a good lawyer. Now, I am going to talk about this book because, well, why did I write this book? Now, I've been on television for a while to talk about the book. So one of these interviewers says, well, I guess what you really want is you're on television to, that's why, you know, you're here to talk, that's why you're on television to talk about the book. I said, no, you don't understand. I said, I wrote this book so I could be on television. I have a point, a more serious point. I'm trying to make a point. I'm trying to make it to the law students. I would like to make the point to college students, to high school students. And it's a serious point. And the point is, why? It's about law. And I get this question all the time. There was a woman who is the president of the court of Ghana in my office about 4 or 5 months ago, and she's doing a good job trying to create a court that will protect human rights and will try to assure democracy. And she says, why do people do what you say? Why do people in the United States follow a rule of law? That's the point. And why? And, it's a long and difficult answer, and there isn't one, and so forth. And I want to give a feeling for it. And I got that question. I tell you where I was in a place called Ouagadougou. Anybody who knows where Ouagadougou is can raise their hand. I'm not looking. Okay. Anyway, it's in Burkina Faso, and I was there in November, and I was talking to 72 judges, the judges of Burkina Faso. They're good judges, and they have the same question. And I said, well, it's a document, it's a very good document, this Constitution. But, it's not just the words on the paper. And I have to tell you a few stories. And I have to say that you're not the first ones that this question occurred to. Indeed, Alexander Hamilton has this question. Or he sort of, he doesn't say it out loud. But look, go back when you're looking at Marbury versus Madison and studying these, great cases. I mean, you read what he says in Federalist Number 78. He says, he puts this question, is a different question, but it gives rise to the one I want to talk about. He says, somebody should have the power to say when parts of the government go beyond what we've written here. He says, this is a great document. He knew it was. Every one of the founders knew they'd written something terrific, and they had. And they knew it. But he says, now if nobody has the power to say when others have gone too far, well, what are we going to do with this? Let's hang it in a museum. It's beautiful. Put it in the National Gallery. He didn't actually say that because they didn't have the National Gallery at that time. But nonetheless, you see the point. He says, somebody has to have the power. Who should it be? The power to say when a law goes too far because this document sets boundaries. And when does this law or other governmental action exceed those boundaries? Well, we could give the power to the president. But if we give him the power, he's already too powerful. Already. I mean, he'll become a dictator. That's too much. The power to say, not only do the thing, but to say whether it's right when you do it. No, that won't work. Congress. After all, it is a democracy. Why not Congress? And many countries do have that kind of system. And they thought, and Hamilton writes there in Federalist 78, he doesn't put it in quite these words, but that's the idea. He says, Congress, he says, well, the trouble is that this document gives precisely the same rights and responsibilities to every person, poor or rich, popular or unpopular. Now, Congress is very safe to rely on when something is popular. Believe me, they know popularity. If they did not know what was popular, they wouldn't be where they are. But what do we do when the person who has the right is unpopular? And it's very unpopular to give them that right. No, that's not a good idea. But here we have a third group over here. Who are they? Judges. Now, I don't even know who they are. Perfect. Nobody knows who they are. They're sort of gray. They're sort of like bureaucrats in a way. I mean, then this is a legal document. They know something about law, and they do not have the power of the purse, and they do not have the power of the sword. Wonderful. They're less likely to go too far. Now, that's what he says. And everyone, it wasn't honestly, no matter what you learned in class, and I doubt you learned this, but John Marshall did not make up the idea of judicial review. It was there in the Continental Congress. And almost everybody thought that was what would come about. So that is what came about, and he did a kind of Houdini activity there in Marbury versus Madison and just made it explicit. But now the court is going to have the power to set aside a law of Congress, which they didn't exercise for a very long time. I mean, then the question arises. Then. I mean, there are just 7 or 8 or 9, or even once there were 10 Supreme Court judges, and maybe there are 1,000 others. And I see one of them, Judge Torea, is here. That's good. Very nice of you to come. Federal judges, if you hear, and state court judges, great. But we know each other, and we know we have strong ideas, but that doesn't mean we have the strength to put them into action. So why do they do what we say? Good question. Now, that's the question I want to shed a little light on for those who don't know the answers, which I don't. The question is simply this. It is Hotspur's question. It is the question of Henry IV. You know, in Henry IV, Shakespeare has Owen Glendower come in, and he's a mystic because he's a Welshman, and in Shakespeare, all Welshmen are mystics. So Owen Glendower says, "I can summon spirits from the vasty deep." But Hotspur is your practical Englishman. And he says to Owen Glendower, "So can I. So can any man. But will they come when you do call for them?" You see? That's the question. Why? And when I try to answer this to the judges in Ouagadougou or the woman who's the president of the Ghana court or anyone else or the people who want to look at the book or whatever, I usually can illustrate it. And I pick out a few stories to illustrate it. And I said, let's start way back in the 1830s when, in fact, there's a case you probably have heard of, but some of you won't know why you've heard of it, but you bet you have. In the northern part of Georgia, the land was owned by the Cherokee Indians. And at that time, they'd given up hunting and fishing. They had an alphabet. They had a constitution. They had a great chief, Chief Ross, and they're absolutely indistinguishable from their neighbors who were not Indians but were Georgians. But then, unfortunately for them, they found gold. I say unfortunately because the Georgians said, why should the Indians have gold? Just because it's on their land? Ha! Let's take it. And so they marched in and took the land. Now, the Indians, being absolutely civilized, did what any civilized man or woman would do. They hired a lawyer. And that lawyer was one of the great lawyers of his day, Willard Wirt. And he eventually, through details I will spare you, got a case with that issue in it to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court of the United States, in a sense, said, well, this is an easy case. The land belongs to the Indians. There are treaties, there are laws, everything. You know, it's their land. It's not the Georgians. And you may have heard of the case because that is the case about which, supposedly, President Andrew Jackson said, well, John Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it. Yeah. And President Jackson sent troops to northern Georgia, but not to enforce the decision, but rather to evict the Indians, which they did. And the Indian tribe marched along what was called the Trail of Tears because so many died along the way to Oklahoma, where their descendants live to this day. That is not a happy beginning to answer Hotspur's question. I mean, it doesn't look as if things are going to go well. Well, I like to bring out a second case which has a happier ending. You have to run the clock way forward. A lot happened in this country. We had a civil war. We had 80 years of racial segregation. And now go to the end of that period. When finally in Brown versus Board, the Supreme Court said and held, no, you can't have, you know, look, the words here are equal protection of the law. Well, I was alive then. I was growing up then in 1954. and anyone just opened their eyes and look what was going on in the South, and not just in the South, and there was no equality there. I mean, it wasn't a hard question. And the court then said, no, there you have to have equal, I mean, no segregation. That's what's equal. So integrate. That's basically what Brown said. Integrate. That was 1954. And you know what happened in 1955? Yeah, that's a good, excellent answer. Quite right, nothing. Basically nothing. And what happened in 1956? Yeah, you got it right again. I mean, next to nothing. And then in 1957, a judge in Little Rock, a federal judge, ordered the Little Rock School Board, which was a kind of moderate group, actually, to integrate Central High School. And they prepared plans, and in September of 57, the Little Rock Nine, some of whom were speaking up here not too long ago. Very interesting, very interesting. They've had very interesting lives. But very brave at that time. And they had been selected by the NAACP because they were willing to do this, to try it, and brave, and good students, and the first week of September, they were to go into that school under the order. Well, over the summer, Governor Faubus, who had started out as a kind of moderate, became a very strong segregationist because he saw the political support from the white citizens' councils. And he said no. And the federal judge said, well, here's the order. Yeah, this is the order. But on the day they were supposed to enter, there were mobs in front of the schools. And Faubus, in a sense, said, it may be true that he has a court order, they have a court order, but I have the state militia. And the state militia was sent there to stop these children from going into the school. And there's a famous picture that was taken. There were reporters from all over the world, and that famous picture was of Elizabeth Eckford. And there's a good book written by Margolick about what happened to her in later life with the woman who was at the other side of the picture, who was actually a student, but her face is there, white student, contorted with rage. And that picture, they became friends later and they had a difficult relation, but it's a very, very interesting story. No, she became very sorry, and then sort of a question there about repentance and how do you do it and so forth. Very interesting story. But in any case, that picture went around the world, and it was not a happy picture for the United States of America. This was going on, and it didn't look good. And Hayes Brooks, who was the congressman from Little Rock, called President Eisenhower and asked him to meet with Governor Faubus. They said they would meet, and Governor Faubus flew up to the summer White House at Newport, and they met. And afterwards, Governor Faubus said, well, he dressed me down like a general dresses down a sergeant. And he told President Eisenhower that he would allow the integration of Central High School, and then he went out and told the press the opposite. Eisenhower was a little annoyed. And so he had to figure out what to do. Now, he took different advice. Now, Jimmy Burns, who was the governor of South Carolina, who had been on the Supreme Court, who had resigned during World War II in order to run our whole mobilization effort at home, was a friend of Harry Truman, was not a segregationist, really, but from the South, and a moderate on race. He sat down with Eisenhower, and he said, if you try to make them integrate by force with troops, he said, do you know what'll happen? He said, you will have to be prepared to reoccupy the whole South. He said, the very best that could happen is they'll close all the schools and nobody will get educated. He said, you better be careful. But Eisenhower's attorney general, Brownell, his wise counselor, said, you've got to do it. I mean, this is a rule of law as well, you say, do it. And he did it. He decided to do it within a few days. And he called up and sent and went on the nationwide television and radio and said 1,000 troops from the 101st Airborne are going to Little Rock. He put them on planes. And everyone at the United States at that time knew the 101st Airborne. They knew who they were. They were the heroes of World War II. They had flown into Normandy, and many of them, their parachutes had gotten hung up on those steeples, and they'd been shot down, and they were heroes of the Battle of the Bulge, and they were a name. So 1,000 101st Airborne paratroopers flew to Little Rock. And the next day, they took those children by the hand. They just escorted them into that school. And pictures went around the world. And that was a great day. It was a great day for equality. It was a great day for the rule of law. It was a great day for America. So I wish I could end that story there. But of course, I can't. Because a lot more happened after that. You couldn't keep the troops there forever. They left by around Thanksgiving. Life was miserable for those nine in that school. Listen to their stories. Really miserable. And towards the spring, a new school board that was very segregationist got elected, and Governor Faubus closed the school. Read the stories of what happened to those children. White and black. They had no school. And it changed their lives, a lot of them. A lot for the worse. There we are. Things are pretty bad. And they finally got that case up to the Supreme Court, whether they could close the school, roughly, called Cooper versus Aaron. Great case. A great case. And court said 9-0, you have to integrate. Now, a lot went on. 9-0. Nine signed the paper. You could have had 90 sign it. You could have had 900. You could have had 9,000. Where's the force? The school was closed. I've telescoped a little. The school was closed the day after that opinion came down. Okay? So now it's going to have a sad ending. But it isn't, you say. Because in my mind, and I'm a judge, so I'm a little bit prejudiced, but in my mind, the die was cast with that opinion, those opinions, the sending of the troops. And that was a lot happened after that. They just couldn't keep the school closed. Too much was going on. The parents got really annoyed. They wanted the education. And we had Martin Luther King. And we had the Freedom Riders. And we had all kinds of things that you know about. So in my own view, yes, that was very important that Eisenhower sent those 1,000 troops. Very important. Very important. Could it solve it by itself? No. But it helped. And that was a great day for law in the United States. See, I explained it this way. When I was in the court a couple of years, I got a call from the State Department, and they said, we're sending over, if you're agreeable, we'd like you to take around this Russian general, a paratroop general, because he had been in charge of pointing all the missiles, and he'd pointed them all at the United States, but then they'd changed direction. And they said, we should be nice to this man. Fine, and I showed him around. He asked me, what do you like? What are your favorite cases? I pointed this Cooper versus Aaron out. See, and I said, I told him the whole story. And I said, you see what that shows? It shows the judges and the paratroopers must be friends. Well, think about that. And now let's jump ahead now. Let's take a case you really hate. I don't know. Some people really hate the abortion cases. Some people really hate the prayer in schools. Some Bush v. Gore. I was in the dissent in Bush v. Gore. And interesting. Interesting. And I heard Harry Reid. In fact, yesterday or the day before, when I was sitting at the inauguration, behind me was Steny Hoyer, who's the whip in the House, and he said the same thing. It's in his mind as a legislator. And I've heard Harry Reid, who's the majority leader, say this. He said came to dinner at our court, and he said the most remarkable thing about Bush v. Gore is something that's very rarely remarked. Very rarely. It's a very unpopular decision in some quarters, probably with half the country. It's an important decision, and despite its unpopularity, and despite the fact that it was very important, and I suspect he also thinks, as I thought, it was very wrong. Wrong, unpopular, important. But people followed it. No guns. Steny Hoyer said, and nobody was shot. Nobody was shot. And Harry Reid said, and no one was killed. And there was no rioting in the streets. And I told him, when I talk about that case to groups in colleges, I say, truthfully, I think that's a great thing. And I said, but I know about 28% of you, when I say there were no riots, some are thinking, oh, and too bad there weren't some. I said, well, before you make your mind up about that, definitely, turn on the television set and see what happens in places where people decide their differences that way. Okay? So just the fact that you probably, or only some of you, or only you a little bit, have thought about that point in relation to those cases, that shows an enormous treasure that the United States has. And that is the treasure that they understand that us, the judges, who we're not known. Law, you know, it's contrary to popular belief, you know, 308 million people in the United States are not lawyers. I mean, we're a group of people pledged to this rule of law, and we're not the majority. And despite that, well, yeah, they'll follow it. I see that every day in the court. I mean, my goodness, I sit in that seat. I see people of every race, every religion, every point of view, and believe me, there are points of view I'd never even heard of before I left Boston. That's amazing. And they'll follow and work out those differences under law. That's the national treasure. You see, that's what I try to tell the judges in Ouagadougou. And I want to say to them and the woman from Ghana and the others and the Chinese who sometimes come, look, it's not just a question. I mean, it's partly, but you don't have to convince the other judges or the government or that's part of it, or the lawyers, but they're all ready to be convinced. Go out there to people who aren't lawyers, who aren't judges, and people in villages if you're down there in Burkina Faso, and try and explain to them what we have here with this rule of law, and that you want some of that. No guarantee it will make you rich. No guarantee it will produce some kind of paradise. But it will help allow people of very different views live together in a society, at least without killing each other, to solve their major differences. So most of what I say here, you see, is aimed at people, teachers, communities, everybody, who can, in fact, help make certain that the next generation, the generation after that, keeps it up. Now, I hate to tell you that's not the whole book, because I can't resist. I can't resist talking a little bit about what I think is the court's responsibility, too. I'll just say a little thing about that, 5 minutes. But I want to explain something about the court, too. Because we have judges, too, have responsibilities here. And I think part of it is to try to get a way of deciding these very difficult cases, or an approach to very difficult cases, an approach to very difficult constitutional cases, that will, in fact, help the system of law work better. You say, well, what's that? I say, well, at least I'm addressing judges and lawyers now. I'm not just talking to school teachers and all the others in the community. That's important. I said, well, it's pretty hard to say. Oh, really? Why should I read further? I said, I'm not saying I have nothing to say. I'm saying it's hard to say because I know what it isn't. It isn't what you think. You go to an audience, a group of people, you say, how does the court really decide these very, very difficult decisions? They'll say all kinds of things, but I say, I know what you're thinking. What you're thinking is politics. That's what you're thinking. You're thinking the Supreme Court of the United States is really sort of a junior varsity Congress. I mean, it's a group of politically oriented people who will decide tough questions on politics. That's what people think. So I say, no, it isn't. You say, well, they think, well, of course you'd say that. What do you think you're going to say? I say, no, look, if it were politics, well, then Hamilton was wrong to give us the job. If you want politics, give it to some politicians. Go back and give it to Congress. They at least know how to do it. And then I like to quote on that in that instance. I mean, For present purposes, it's a great case. It's actually a terrible case, but for present purposes, it's a good illustration, which is Dred Scott. I mean, how did Roger Taney ever decide that case, saying that a person descended from slaves was not a person and therefore could not bring an action in the United States since he isn't a person? I mean, great, wonderful, wonderful case. The fact is, the only ground I've ever seen where it's a kind of, they try to give a justification for that, was a political ground. He thought by doing that he would prevent the Civil War. Well, if that's what he thought, he helped bring about the Civil War. I mean, Lincoln took up the dissent in that case, written by a great Boston judge, Curtis, and he read that out at Cooper Union in New York, and it sort of, the dissent was fabulous. And that's why we write dissents, we hope to write. But nonetheless, the fact is that it promoted Lincoln as head of the Republican Party, and the more, he wasn't an abolitionist exactly, but that is where they were headed. And once Lincoln and the Republicans won, the Civil War was almost inevitable. And so it had the opposite effect. Lesson? Why not political? Because judges are terrible politicians. They all had some exposure to politics, and they think they're wonderful, but they're not. If you want real politicians, give it to Congress, all right? Not the judges. Well, there are theories like originalism, you know, go back and look at what George Washington thought. And I read a little bit about that, but I mean, they say, why don't I think that's so wonderful? I say, because Nino Scalia and I sometimes discuss this publicly, and we enjoy doing that. We like it, actually, because people learn something from it, and they begin to understand you can have different points of view and still be very, very serious and sincere in your point of view. And what I usually say to him is, well, you know, George Washington didn't know about the internet, and he says, thank you, I didn't know that. You know, in these really difficult cases, you're not going to find much help in history. And he, whenever I say, have my series of wonderful criticisms that I find so convincing for me, he says, well, you know, the story really of the two campers. And he says, the story of the two campers. And it's one of them that sees the other putting on his running shoes. And he says, why are you putting that on your running shoes on? He says, because there's a bear coming. He says, well, you can't outrun a bear. He says, yeah, but I can outrun you. All right, so that's what part of this is devoted to. He says, I want to say, look, that isn't quite so as much as you think. That is that there is another point of view. Now, there is a tradition. There is a tradition in American life, a tradition in the American judiciary. It goes back to 1790, where I think a judge from Rhode Island expressed it very well. He said, American judges, he said, American law, in deciding questions of appeals, in deciding difficult questions of the meaning of law, he says they use prudence and pragmatism, they use reasonableness and utility. I like that, because I like those four words. And I'm sure if I can imagine Justice Scalia here, and I'm putting words in his mouth, he's usually much more polite. He says, oh, good, you've graduated to the level of bumper sticker. So I say, okay, yeah, that is a little bit of bumper sticker, but I want to spell some of that out. And I want to use examples, which I will spare you most of, but I want those examples to show how, what it is I think we do, which is to take values in the Constitution that don't change. Free expression means about what it means now, and it meant then, but applying it to circumstances that change every 5 minutes. It is true, George Washington did not know about the internet, but the First Amendment applies to the internet. So a lot of the job that's so difficult is to take those values that don't change and try to apply them to circumstances that change minute by minute. Part of it is what I call, and what Mike said, that you're trying to do this in a way that will allow the government to work, which means get the branches to cooperate and just don't always think about their separation. And part of it is figuring out what are those basic values, but that isn't as difficult as you think. Because I think all nine of us, and those who have been around here for a while, will say underlying this Constitution, if you're talking in terms of real values, basic values, they'll say, what does this document do? You say, well, the first seven parts of it are designed to produce what has become a democracy. That means that people make their own decisions about what kinds of communities what kinds of cities, towns, and states they want. And it's a special kind of democracy. It's a democracy that protects basic human rights. It's a democracy that assures a degree of equality. It's a democracy that separates powers in three parts, horizontally and state, federal, vertically, so no group of people within government becomes too powerful. And it's a democracy that insists on a rule of law. So once you say that, you haven't said nothing. It's not quite a bumper sticker. And it does encapsulate not one thing, but four or five things that the rest of this Constitution, quite a lot of it, sort of elaborates upon. You say, what are the judges there? Well, the judges, if you want a metaphor, I think of the judges. They're not umpire isn't the right word, but I think of them as the border patrol. That's good. I used to listen when I was a little younger than you to a program. It was called, the Canadian Mounted Police. I can't remember his name. I just slipped my mind. But anyway, it was the Canadian Mounted Police, and he was out there on the frontier of Canada, and it was always very cold out there. All right. And life was rough at the boundary. And it is abortion inside or outside the boundary. And what about that school prayer? But the fact that we're at the boundary, people forget that between the boundaries, there's a vast area. Vast, where everybody agrees these decisions are up to the public through their elected representatives. Everybody agrees to that. So don't get mixed up that we're suddenly deciding everything. We're over here at the boundary. That's our part. But you have the values, you have a role for the court. And then I think there's something called pragmatism. But pragmatism is something like this. It isn't just do whatever you think is good. Absolutely not. Take a typical case. It's not going to be right on one side and wrong on the other side. It's going to be right on both sides. It's going to involve something like, free speech on one side, but personal privacy on the other. And how do we weigh these two things? And you can spell out pragmatic approach. I'll give you one example. I'll give you one of many, because I think it's an interesting example, and you probably know about it. When I was your age, I remember going down with the peninsula in San Francisco, where I lived with my mother, and she said at Tan Phran Racetrack, we passed that, that's where they kept the Japanese in World War II. At least they went there at the beginning. And what she was referring to, which I knew, was in World War II, they took about 70,000 American citizens of Japanese origin and just moved them against their will and held them in camps in Eastern California and in the Intermountain region. And how did that happen? I mean, finally, that case got to the Supreme Court. It was called Korematsu. That's the main case. It got there in 1944. The reason that President Roosevelt did this, he did it at the request of General DeWitt, who was head of the 6th Army in San Francisco, was because he said, there's been all kinds of signaling. People were afraid of an invasion from Japan. And he said there'd been all kinds of signaling, 735 instances, he said. And there's been sabotage. And we just got to move them. And I don't know who's who. And that's it. And Roosevelt said, yeah, that's it. Okay, we'll move them. And they did. And they did, you say. But Fred Korematsu, whom I actually met over here in Cambridge, because where we live, our next-door neighbor, by just a coincidence, was from San Francisco. Her father was Ernie Bezig, who was the head of the ACLU in San Francisco, and my dad, and he used to play poker. And so she said, come over there, somebody interesting you'd like to meet. And there he was, Fred Korematsu, in his 80s. He's still feisty. He was great. And his parents hadn't wanted him to bring this case, but he said, I'm an American, and they can't do this. And he had a hard time getting representation. And the ACLU said to Bezig, you're on your own. They came in later. But that's war, you say. They got this up to the Supreme Court. And by that time, a couple of lawyers in the Justice Department took an interest. I think it was Burling and Insmer or something. And they got suspicious of all these reasons being given. And they called in the FCC and said, were there 739 instances? Look into it. Were there, in fact, all these sabotage? Go look into it, they asked the FBI. And 3 weeks later, the FCC comes back with a stack of paper like this, and the FBI is over here. They say, well, how many instances of signaling? No, there were no instances of signaling. Zero. They were all buck privates who didn't know how to work the machines. And he said, well, the FBI said there was no sabotage. There was no sabotage. J. Edgar Hoover had been against this from the beginning. He was. And so they said, well, how'd you do that work so quickly? He said, we didn't do work quickly. This was all done at the time. And we showed it to General DeWitt. So they said, we're not signing the brief. And they bring in to sort of mediate this in the God, who's the famous Columbia law professor who did criminal law? What? Wexler, Herbert J. Wexler, exactly. Herbert J. Wexler. And he mediated it, and he wrote a footnote, and it's absolute gobbledygook, but they agreed to sign it. And if you read it very closely, you can see the department is saying, don't pay any attention to what the War Department's telling you, if you read it closely. So I'd always thought, well, the Supreme Court never understood it. Then I listened to the transcript. I got the transcript of the oral argument. Charlie Horsky, who is representing the Japanese American Defense League, says to the court, read that footnote. He says, read it five times so you understand it. So I think they understood it. But 6-3, they upheld it. 6-3. Okay. And I mean, and these were civil libertarians. Black wrote the opinion. Douglas. The dissent was Jackson, Murphy, Roberts. When I read those dissents, I think, well, Murphy never gets credit for anything. It's a very good dissent, right on target. And Jackson had something else to say, and Roberts. But why did the six uphold it? And my own view of this after reading it five times is they're thinking this way. You see, someone has to run this war. It's Roosevelt or us. And we can't do it. Right? Now, why do I tell you that? Because that's a kind of problem that comes up to us in cases like Guantanamo. Everybody thinks that decision's terrible, Korematsu. And everybody, I think it was terrible. But here's the problem. And this is so typical of the kinds of really tough cases when they're really important. Look, you have a problem of securing the United States, security. Where does the Constitution give that power? It gives it to the president and Congress, not the court. Okay? But, the court has the responsibility under the Constitution, certainly to protect the individual rights of human beings, no matter how unpopular they are. So how do we deal with this? And if you read those Guantanamo cases, if I were to pick one sentence out, after all, we had four cases. Every one of them was a person from who was being detained at Guantanamo, like Bin Laden's chauffeur, for example, not the most popular person in the United States. And he's suing George Bush, who's the most powerful person in the world. And in every one of them, the detainee wins, and the George Bush loses. All right? Sentence that I think is important, Sandra O'Connor. The Constitution does not write the president a blank check. Close to a bumper sticker. But then we apply it. We apply it. Now, nobody likes the way we applied it. The civil libertarians say, well, you should have been more specific. You should have been more detailed. You should have said specifically, this is wrong, that's wrong, the other's wrong. We said what was there. We said you have to go to the courts. We said a statute of Congress saying you can't go to court is unconstitutional. We said you have to give them some kind of elements of due process, but you should have been a lot more specific than that. The other side says you're destroying the country. There's going to be no... Da, da, da. You understand where we are. Okay, so why not go further? What's the honest answer? Because we don't know. We don't know exactly what's going to come up, because these are pretty tough decisions, because it's true that there's a security interest, because it's true that there is a interest in making certain that people's basic liberties are protected. And you say, well, okay, let's look and see what Madison said about that. He said nothing about that, not directly. You see? Now, history will say whether we're on the right track here or not, and we'll advance as we have to advance. But I'm trying to give you a little flavor for how I think it works in practice, though I've simplified. I simplify a lot for this purpose. I want to give you a little insight there as to how it works, but I want you to get the main point. And the main point is that so far, it has worked, not perfectly by any means. There have been lots of ups and downs across our history, lots. And the court's been responsible for some of those downs as well as some of those ups. And they're human. And that means they will continue to decide things that are important, you know, they're important to people. And protecting sometimes very unpopular people. And doing things that are very unpopular and quite possibly wrong because they're human. And that's the institution that you have to try to explain to the 308 million people who aren't lawyers. And that the judges in Ouagadougou have to explain to the people in the villages. And that the ones in Egypt are out there trying to explain in those towns. And that the president of the Ghanaian court is going to have to explain to quite a few people all across Ghana. And unless she gets help in that and others help, well, it's just not going to happen. But we have it so far. So far. It's there as a treasure. So far. So, motto of the story, know your government, not just you, but the people you talk to. Know something of the history. Participate in that government. And we're trying to keep what I call this national treasure. Thanks.
Questions, and Anne, will somebody walk around with a microphone? Okay, so if you just raise your hands, we'll direct people. Oh, there's one over there. Caitlin, thank you.
Hi, welcome to BU, Justice Breyer. Thanks for being here. You spoke a lot about how the court should be insulated from political pressures, popular opinion, and such. But I'm interested in your thoughts about the other direction. When the court has taken a position that's unpopular, how do you think that decision impacts popular opinion? Does it make people react reflexively to be digging in their heels and more set in their ways? Or do you think that the court going against the grain can sometimes help accelerate a change in thought?
So the answer really is sometimes yes, sometimes no. But I think, for example, after Bush v. Gore, the court's popularity went way down, but mostly among people who identified themselves with the more left part of politics. And over the next few years, it went up again, and then it went down again in the polls because they were getting a lot of attacks from the right. All right, so it's like that. It's like that. But overall in the country so far, if we take modern times, last 50, 70 years, the court's held in pretty high esteem. They're up there almost with the firemen, policemen, and nurses. But so I think you just have to sort of continue doing what you think is correct here, and you simply have to hope. But my point here is that the more people know about what it is that we do, what it is, the better, and at least they'll understand. And I think people do understand in this country pretty well, and when they do, at least they're more tolerant of people who don't agree with them. It's when they don't understand that the problem arises. And of course they can sometimes, the court, I think it did promote a desegregation. No other institution was doing anything. It was taking a long time. It was after World War II. Eisenhower, I'd read in his thing, he grew up, you know, in a segregationist city, in a town in Missouri. And he said, but when he saw people fighting, they had black battalions in World War II. He ended up World War II thinking the segregation is ridiculous. And he became a person who really promoted it, not saying so much about it, but promoting the integration. Within the Army, within the District of Columbia, and eventually in Little Rock. But we didn't talk about it.
Hi, Justice Breyer. Thank you very much for joining us today. You mentioned in Brown v. Board, one of the parts of that decision involves some sociology, and I was wondering how central would you say are developments in either sociology or science for how the court decides cases as we go forward.
I probably am at one sort of extreme in the fact that I think the more we, I like to go a little bit afield, if that's relevant. And I usually say we get a lot of amicus briefs, amicus curiae. In the affirmative action cases, there were about 100. In the right to, is there an assisted right to assisted suicide? There were about 80. And in that case, we got some amicus curiae briefs from nurses groups, from doctors groups, from hospice workers, and on both sides. Some were for, some were against, you know, and retarded people's groups, and all kinds of things.
Mrs. Breyer, my question is, do you think since, you know, you have technology, you know, the Founding Fathers never heard of the internet and so on and so forth, and the changes in the country, do you think the text of the Constitution will needs to or will change in the future, in the coming years?
I mean, there are only 27 amendments. That's over 200 years. You've got to think long and hard before amending the Constitution. You get an amendment that you think is great for your purposes, some people get one you don't think is quite so great. So it's a very risky process, amending the Constitution. Go see Lincoln, good movie. That was tough to get that through. I'd never known how tough that was, but that was pretty important. 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments changed the Constitution dramatically, and for the better, obviously. Prohibition, that was a big mistake.
I do want to thank all of the law school staff as well as the staff at the court who worked so hard on this day, and thank you to the U.S. Marshals Service as well. And finally, of course, thank you, Justice Breyer. I think sometimes in sort of the throes of the day and our minor, what really are minor worries, we forget that we do in fact have a national treasure, and we're very grateful to you for reminding us of that, but also for letting us see that it is in very safe and good hands. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer on his new book, Making Democracy Work, A Judge's View. Justice Breyer's lecture was presented by the Boston University School of Law. Tonight's moderator was School of Law Dean Maureen O'Rourke. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us. We'll